Good morning, everyone. My name is Pierce Homer, and I have the pleasure and honor of serving Governor Payne, Secretary of Transportation, and Chair of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. This morning, we're going to continue the work session items. We have one item left over from yesterday. It should take about 15 minutes. And then we're going to go into our business agenda, and we will start that business agenda with public commentary, as is our custom. Before we do that, however, I do want to recognize two individuals. First, the commissioner, and then followed by some welcome remarks by the mayor of the city of Lynchburg, who is able to join us this morning. Commissioner?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the CTB, ladies and gentlemen. There's a display in the room here this morning that I wanted to call people's attention to. Last week, we commemorated Work Zone Safety Week nationally, and that is a period throughout the country where we try to highlight not only the contributions that professionals and road workers make both on the private and public sector side, but oftentimes in those events or in those activities, we lose lives because those are dangerous areas, as we all know, both for the workers and for people who drive through those work zones. So last week, throughout the country, there were a series of these commemorations that went on. In the Commonwealth, on Monday the 7th, we commemorated our work zone events at a rest area or at a lookout that we have on I-64. As you drive on I-64 towards Charlottesville from I-81, you'll see on the side of the road there's a monument. On that monument, which was constructed through all donations, you'll find the name of all employees that have been killed in the line of duty. As a part of that, these cones represent the 9 operating districts of the department and our central office, and our key partner in this commemoration last week, VTCA, the Virginia Transportation Construction Association. And it's significant because you'll see that the employees of every district have signed those cones. So if you go through each of those 11 cones, you'll find 8,315 names on those cones. And I wanted the CTV to be able to see that commitment that our people make before we return them to the districts. This was a labor of love by the employees, and very frankly, I'm really proud to be associated with a professional group that does that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. At this point, I'd like to recognize our sponsoring entity, which is the City of Lynchburg and their wonderful Mayor Joan Foster. Mayor, if you would like to come up and say a few words of welcome, and I know you have large and unmet needs here in the city. We heard about them loud and clear on the bus tour yesterday, but we do welcome your comments.
Well, thank you so much. I really want to welcome you, Secretary Warner, Commissioner Eckern, Director Tucker, and distinguished members of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We're so thrilled that you have selected our fine city to hold your conference. It's just a pleasure to have you here. I'm sorry I couldn't join the tour yesterday. I do have a daytime job, and that called me, but I'm happy that you were able to do that. I understand some took walking tours as well. And, you know, being in our downtown, we're very proud of the things that we have done downtown, and I know there's a lot more to do. So that's sort of a tickler to tell you to please come back and visit us, you know, just on your leisure time. It's my pleasure, as I said, to welcome you to our city and to the greater Region 2000, because we definitely are a region, and I'm a member of the Executive Council, and I'm so proud of our region, and we are more and more getting our acts together and working together, which can only benefit our entire region when we do that. Some of you have had that opportunity to tour our beautiful region, so not only did you tour Lynchburg, you toured our region yesterday, and I hope that was an enjoyable tour. I know that you heard from the area managers on your tour yesterday and during the public hearing last night about the transportation needs of the region. I was told I might could go on a bit about that, but you heard last night, and I really do feel that you heard from the best sources, and I won't belabor that, but please remember that. You have a challenging task in time of inadequate revenues and increasing needs, not unlike those of us in local government. We see that. We are now presently doing our budget, and we had to make some things stretch and fill in some gaps and put aside some reserves to fill in those gaps because we still have unfunded mandates from the state. And unfortunately, we still have to do them, but we do set aside a little bit of funding for that. It wasn't a little bit. It was over $800,000 this year. So we are glad we did do that reserve. Despite these difficulties, though, I hope that you will be able to engage in some innovative thinking to address the transportation needs of the Commonwealth. And it's going to probably be very innovative and creative considering the times that we are in. I believe, though, that you're going to hear later today about some opportunities for enhanced passenger rail service to this area. And I encourage you to support such alternatives to complement the highway system. You know, at one time we did run on the rails, and a lot of rails came through our area, so that is a very huge interest of mine, and I hope that you all will seriously consider that. Allow me to acknowledge to Secretary Horner and to Commissioner Eckrin the good relationship that the local governments in this region have with VDOT Lynchburg District. We value our partnership with VDOT, and only adequate funding would make it better. Finally, I want to thank our own CTB member, Ken White, for his service to our community and to the Commonwealth for bringing you to Lynchburg for this meeting. I think, thank you. Enjoy your stay. And I do hope that you come back. And I hope you have an enjoyable visit, as I said. And please check out our downtown and come back for pleasure. And I would be available to give a personal tour at any time. So thank you so much for your dedication as well to the Commonwealth. Because, you know, what we do is not easy. And it's getting harder. So I appreciate everything you do in your volunteer spirit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mayor. Okay, continuing on from yesterday's work session, the final item was an overview of the six-year maintenance and operations budget, and Connie Sorrell is presenting. Welcome, Ms. Sorrell. Mayor, don't forget your glasses.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, and members of the board. I have a fairly short presentation about the budget for maintenance and operations. You may remember last year, for the first time, we included an item in the transportation six-year plan that shows the estimate for funding for the next 6 years for maintenance and operations for each district. So I'm going to go through just a few of the highlights. I just want to start out with a few definitions. Sometimes it's not always clear what the difference between maintenance and operations and construction may be. We usually refer to ordinary maintenance as those things that just keep things running, thinking about changing the oil in your car. These are just your basic everyday things that mow mowing the ditches, cleaning out, I mean, mowing grass, cleaning ditches, and those kinds of things, and some preventative equipment maintenance. Maintenance rehabilitation usually is used to refer to repairing an asset or trying to extend its life. So pavement milling and overlay, some bridge superstructure rehabilitation, repairing decks, those kinds of things. And some small thing, replacement types of activities like pipe replacement. Maintenance reconstruction is one of those areas where it begins to get a little fuzzy when things go from being maintenance to being full reconstruction. And as you can see in the six-year plan, there are an awful lot of bridge projects that are really the replacement of old bridges. That the maintenance program just isn't financially equipped to handle under the maintenance moniker. But, so we think about maintenance reconstruction as when it becomes time to restore an asset to its original condition after its life cycle has expired. So bridge replacements, large-scale deck replacements, complete reconstruction of major sections of pavements are the types of things we think about when we think about maintenance reconstruction. And increasingly, these projects are being done by the construction side of the house. Operations we think about in terms of just operating the network, trying to make it more efficient, the typical traffic engineering types of work, signal optimization efforts, operating the ferries, the tunnels, rest areas. We have 41 rest areas. It takes a little money to keep them looking nice. And also all of our traveler information programs and the safety service patrols and incident management, things we do in that arena. So probably the one message I would hope that you take away today is in this chart. This is the difference between the raw dollars in the blue line, where we have been getting increasing funding for maintenance and operations over the last several years. Back in 2005, there was actually about a $100 million jump from 04 to 05, particularly for pavement work. And we did spend that money in pavement work and continue to do that. However, if you were to look at the cost of fuel and petroleum products like asphalt, you would see that over the last 3 or 4 years, we've lost about 35% of our buying power. And so we are working very hard to try and continue to meet our performance standards and targets that we have for pavements and bridges. But as you can see, our ability to do that is declining. So we're trying to make the very best decisions as economically as we can. Becoming increasingly more difficult. During this time period of 04 to 07, 08, the price of a ton of asphalt has gone from about $62 or $3 to over $90. So that's really depicted in the next slide that shows you back in 2004, a mile of a normal overlay for a road was about $35,000 a mile. And last year, that same mile took $54,000. So the numbers for 08 aren't in yet. I think we still have a couple of bids for Brian maybe reporting those. He can tell you a little bit more about where the 08 numbers are going, but they're not going down. So I think the price of oil now has reached about $113 a barrel. So that's not good news. This is just a chart to show you really the overview. I think the Secretary used this in a presentation and to the General Assembly that just shows where the whole transportation program is going. We now have about $1.2 billion in the maintenance program, and you can see how it's distributed among the nine districts and for the statewide programs at the very end. Local government payments for city street maintenance is now about $325 million. Rail and public transportation, $358 million. And the construction program for 2008 was about $1.3. So you can see that it's the maintenance program is every bit as large, and now with the reduced revenues is going to be overtaking the construction program in terms of the total budget. The next slide just breaks down for you by the interstate primary, secondary operations and our management direction overhead budgets, how much money we're spending in each of these categories. So you can see about $276 million of that goes to interstate maintenance. The primary and secondary are each getting $370 million, we're spending a little over $140 million all total. $122 million for the transportation operations, which include the traffic management center, safety service patrols, all the tunnels and ferries, and then the management direction is broken up between the field, which is about $70 million, and central office, which is about $15 million, for a total of 1.25. So kind of gives you an idea from a system standpoint about what it takes to what we're spending, how we're spending the money by system to maintain the network and operate it. This is the update proposal for the 09 through 014 budgets by district. And what we've done this year is we've tried to take the money. You may remember last year we set aside 2%. We didn't distribute all 4% of the increase in the out years, because we knew that as we do our condition assessments and improve the indoor inventory information we have about the condition of the system, there are some changes. And so we wanted to be able to make sure that we could make adjustments with that small amount of increase without having to reduce any district's budget as we move forward. So for 09 and 010, we have distributed all but 1%, holding that back as a part of our emergency contingency fund. And so in out years 11 through 14, there's still about a 2% reserve, and that 4% that will go to the field, but we're going to wait to distribute it until we get a little better information as we get closer to those years. So as you can see, the budget is going to be going this from about $1.5 billion, which includes the payments to localities, to a little over $2 billion by 2014. I'd be happy to answer any questions about the budget.
Chairman, couple different ones. You had mentioned the asphalt costs today, and you weren't sure where they are, but when I go through the book that we got yesterday and some of the bids we've received earlier, it looks like a lot of the construction costs as a whole have gone down. That's not coming from the asphalt. What do you know which elements it's coming from? Is that just labor and other materials?
I don't know. Probably Byron Coburn, who will be up shortly, is our state construction engineer, and he's much more knowledgeable. You know, a lot of commodities worldwide, you know, continue to increase largely because of demands in China and India.
And then on your last chart, you showed the maintenance, and you see some of them across board. And in a couple of cases, let's take Bristol and Salem, FY09, FY10. Those do not go up between the 2 years. They're level funded, whereas you look at, say, Lynchburg, it goes from 84 to 93. What sort of guides the maintenance payments that are in here, and why do some go up and others not in any particular year?
We have a fairly rigorous quantitative process for looking at all the interstate primary, secondary pavements and what condition they're in, and we have estimates of what it would take to meet our target, which is to have no less than 18% of pavements in the primary interstate, for example, in deficient condition. We have 100% of our bridges every 2 years are evaluated, and we have numbers for that. So where you see a district not going up, they either have their system is in relatively good condition, and when we look at the distributing the money based on equity of needs. So for the total number of needs, if we had $1.5 billion worth of needs to meet those performance targets, we look at what each district's share of those needs are and distribute the money according to their share of the needs.
So these sort of targeted to specific maintenance projects,
yes.
And that's what you're able to say, okay, to do these projects, it's going to cost this much, and it's not sort of a, well, you get 10% and you get 15%.
Well, at the statewide level, we don't identify the specific project, but we have the information available for the district to identify that specific allocation. In September of 07, the department did a report, which was required by code, to the General Assembly and the board and the secretary on what every 2 years we have an official report we do on what the needs are to meet the performance targets. And this past year for 08, the needs were right around $1.49 billion. So obviously some of those needs are met from the construction program. So as you can see, you know, many of the bridges that are going to be fixed will add to the improvement in the bridge conditions, which will help take some of the pressure off of the maintenance program. So I hope that helps.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about slide 5. It gives us an interesting breakdown of the relative importance of the various systems and allocations by district. But what I wonder is, is this being benchmarked against sort of a preferred set of allocations, or does having this information then drive strategic discussions about a potential adjustments, like Northern Virginia, for example, is light on maintenance but heavy on rail, or vice versa? Or is this just for our information? In other words, do you use this in the aggregate and plot the trends and just see, vis-a-vis the needs of a district, we may be doing too much in one area and not enough in another?
Mr. Secretary will probably answer that.
I might give a little bit of historical context. Back in 2002, when maintenance had been flatlined over the six-year program, a legitimate question was asked by this body. Well, doesn't it cost a little bit more to maintain a highway, particularly as they age? And indeed, that was true on the face of it. What was begun was a very significant analytical effort, first by BDOT, then we put into the code the requirement that all nodes identify their maintenance needs first, whether it's ports, airports, highways, rail, transit, and name. It's actually a relatively easy thing for an airport to develop, you know, assets. They're behind a fence. The Department of Rail and Public Transportation has worked with providers to develop a very significant asset management system. Nobody has done more, though, in a very large, nearly 60,000-mile, 20,000-bridge network than VDOT to identify assets, what do we own, and then what is the condition. It has taken until last year, so almost 5 years, to really develop a reliable database for interstate, for primary, for secondary. We're also working with the locality to develop comparable performance measures for the local state, the urban state. That's been a little bit of a struggle because they're in a different place and they typically have particularly city infrastructure. The bottom line, though, is that we now have enough of a sampling process and a methodology in place to be able to project out 5-6 years what it will take to keep, and really the key is what percentage of your pavements are to be deficient. I believe that stands about 19%.
18 is the target.
Mm-hmm. There's a similar standard for bridges. There's a similar standard for drainage. There's a similar standard for unpaved shoulders. There's a similar standard for guardrail. There's a similar standard for striping. And what we have done over time is to move away from a system where in 2002 everybody got X percent more than they did the previous year. And there was a complete disconnect between the allocation of maintenance dollars and the actual need. And the thing we do know about maintenance, it will change over time depending upon age, weather events, traffic volumes, weight of vehicles in particular. And so those need assessments are updated every year for all of those asset categories. I think it's fair to say we have excellent data on bridges, interstate and primary. The secondary system is so large, though, that those numbers do tend to swing because there's a statistical sampling exercise for them. That gets built into a needs-based formula. which I'm guessing in by the second or third year were 100%. There were a number of districts that were held harmless. So when you see districts that are held flat in the early years of that six-year maintenance program, that is the phase-in process to move away from the allocating based on what we've done over many decades versus a true needs-based allocation. Is it year three of this year, of this six-year program, where it's entirely needs-based?
Yes, it is. I think I understand it. Yes, we're at the point where each district, I think, will have 99% of their share of the needs and of the funding based on their share of the needs. So, yes, it's always a little struggle that they, you know, kind of shifts just a little bit back and forth, but we're closing the gap finally between those who had more enough or more than what they needed as opposed to those who were somewhat behind.
And this is a very, very important milestone. If you look at this surface transportation spending snapshot, if you have VDOT maintenance and mortality payments, in every district but for one, more is spent being spent on maintenance than construction. That one district is Northern Virginia. If you took Woodrow Wilson Bridge out of Northern Virginia, Northern Virginia, too, would be spending more on maintenance and construction. And so we are in a situation rapidly. You've all seen the chart. We're spending more on maintenance, less on construction. What's that mean? That means not only new capacity, but as Ms. Sorrell pointed out initially, that the very significant replacement. So when a bridge, Wilson Bridge in your district, Mr. Kuhlbeck, when it reaches the end of its useful life, that's too expensive for the maintenance. So those big replacement projects are funded through the six-year program. There's less money available for that. And that's the dilemma we face. So it's not just that you've got this contrast between maintenance and construction, which is a very important dynamic, but when you have shrinking construction dollars, you have shrinking replacement dollars. So a major tunnel rehabilitation, a major bridge, concrete highway, say 295 in the Richmond district, or 664 at Hampton Roads, where you have pavement failure, 66 outside of the Beltway. Those are so big and so expensive, they cannot be accommodated in the maintenance program. And we're now where the ordinary maintenance is outpacing our ability to do that. And remember Mr. Wallace's presentation on bridges, the demographic bulge, I think someone said, boy, that's like my retirement age. It's very, very true. So we face a two-pronged dilemma. As our maintenance costs go up, construction goes down, we know we can't do capacity enhancements, the turn lanes, the widenings, the interchanges that help mobility. But we also have less ability to do those replacement of bridges and highways.
Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to hear that, and the reason I brought it up is I think as we build these databases and gather the information and begin to have a true picture, our ability to mine that information and understand that, you know, things that are happening in one place differ from another place, that whether it's pavement, you know, life, or whether it's accident data or whatever, that will give us a lot of guidance going forward as opposed to just our intuitive feel for how things may be working. So I'm encouraged that we're actually on this track and look forward to kind of having that additional tool in our kit here.
If I may, I'd like to just quickly, is there a hint? As you think about moving forward, last month I briefed the board on an event that occurred in February. If you tie that back to Ms. Sorrell's first slide this morning, where she showed you four categories of how we think about what we do. You take the top category called ordinary maintenance and the bottom category called operations. The impact of the events that we've been having in freeway closures, snow and ice control, if you combine those two, it really defines our everyday service component that we have to provide on the existing system. next month I will bring to the board the long-range investment plan to enhance our emergency response capacity and capability, which will affect the dollars in those two categories. So while we tend to want to think about the pavement and what we need to do, there is a price tag for service. And that is, and as I briefed the board last month, we're going to try to rearrange funding within the service component of that maintenance budget that we all think of as maintenance budget to make sure that our emergency response capability is there, that the message signs work, that all the other tools that we need to be able to respond to freeway closures, snow and ice, hurricanes are in place and in top condition. So this kind of affects this system as you move forward, and we need to be aware of that as and we'll give you the price tag around that as we move forward.
Okay, any other questions or comments? I would say this is a very, very important part of our oversight responsibilities, and I think over the course of the year we're going to continue to look at the data and the underlying facts. This was done by the seat of the pants 6-7 years ago. It's a very professionally run organization, but it's important to understand the analysis and the assumptions underlying that, since it is where we spend a lot of money. Thank you. Before we begin the business section, I'd just like to call everybody's attention at your places. The tentative allocation, just as you have a grasp of your program, you have a graph of the enhancement grants for folks to look at. If you have a comment here, please get that back to Mr. Estes. Comments or questions, welcome there. Okay, I'd like to call to order the April business meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. As is our custom, we'll begin with public comment. We have 9 people signed up to speak. I'll ask people to limit their commentary to not more than 3 minutes. Mr. Mark Greger is the first speaker, to be followed by Skip Ressel. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to come speak with you. My name is Mark Greger, and I'm the CEO of Virginia Regional Transportation Association. It's a 501c3 serving about 17% of rural Virginia as a transit provider. I'm here at the request of the towns of Ashland, the towns of Haymarket, and at the direction of my board of directors. I'm here to request you to amend the program of projects to include funding for these communities and the inner city bus proposal that was submitted on grant applications to the Virginia Department of Rail and Public Transportation. The planning and feasibility have been completed, and I've handed out packets to you that have the studies that have been enclosed. And we do not understand why other rural communities are entitled to mass transit funding, and these towns are asking, why are we not entitled to mass transit funding? Why is it not being made available? The percentage, and we believe, and at least what I'm here to tell you, is that we believe the percentage authorized by the General Assembly that was taken off the top for administration results in no funding for service to these rural communities, and I'm not familiar with other projects, but whatever projects weren't funded, that money is going to the percentage taken off the top. It's the first time in 11 years of submission of to DRPT that we have not been allocated for a new start or for a rural transit system. These are 1 and 2 bus systems in small communities that have requested it. Each of these communities agrees to contribute up to 32% of the cost of this service, so they're making a commitment. And in your packets are the resolutions from the town councils authorizing us to apply for this funding. We also believe that the new business plan for DRPT has removed rural transit as a separate priority, and the result from our perspective is a loss in funding. The accountability, economic benefit, asset management programs that are in place are placing an undue burden on 1 or 2 bus systems in small communities where towns and villages annually commit extensive resources, and over 5 years of double-digit passenger increases have already justified the investment. But a one-bus system to have auditors or an analyst come out from the state and audit the performance of that particular single bus system does place an undue burden. And I know we have an obligation to report to you and to the community and be transparent in our operations. But it does place an undue burden that they're not prepared for, that we don't have the resources or staff to answer the questions and provide the data as requested. From us, it looks like an unfunded mandate to do additional work that we haven't done in the past. And the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, we believe, provides less support and less as a partner than it did 1, 2, or 5 years ago. They've, from our perspective, they've become a bureaucracy that focuses on audit function, not passenger service, and they're not a partner with us in our operations. In closing, I ask that the CTB amend the program of projects to include the about $750,000 for these worthwhile projects. I ask this not as Mark McGregor, but as on behalf of the towns of Ashland, towns of Haymarket, and for the people along the 81, 11, and 66 corridor where we proposed an inner city bus proposal. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. McGregor. The next speaker is Skip Russell, to be followed by Russell Ford.
My name is Skip Russell. I'm president of the Rondo Corporation in Martinsville, and I'm here in my capacity as a resident of Henry County. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly about a matter I hope you will find worthy. We understand that in this initial stage of planning of the I-73 corridor, it is critical that the state observe the federal environmental laws and that there is a lawsuit pending regarding another section of I-73 near the Roanoke area. We do not wish to interfere with the law or the lawsuit since I-73 is so desperately needed for our section of state. This past November, the Henry County Board of Supervisors passed a resolution requesting that you and VDOT reconsider the alignment chosen for the proposed I-73 through our county. Reasons for the request are manifold. Here are only 7. A different alignment would bring easier access to our industrial parks and the Martinsville Speedway, facilities that are critical to our economic rebound. Our Board of Supervisors requests that the 58 bypass roadway be part of the proposed interstate. This change has water and sewer problems installed, meaning new businesses could be attracted more quickly. Using the existing 58 bypass could save 8 to 10 years of time raising money and construction. Using VDOT's figures, this could save almost $500 million because 6¾ miles will not have to be built. The Henry County Board of Supervisors has signatures from 185 businesses that are enthusiastically supporting this change. The proposed VDOT route will not properly serve these businesses, and that is the reason they're asking you for this change. On the Board of Supervisors route, there are multiple intermodal access points, of which there are none on the proposed VDOT route. We are aware of this potential and as a tremendous asset. Lastly, if the proposed VDOT route is not changed, future maps will show 2 blue lines as close as a mile apart, paralleling each other, completely bypassing Martinsville. Seems like a waste. All we ask is that you consider the request of the Henry County Board of Supervisors. Ask VDOT to work with the FHWA without prejudicing or otherwise affecting litigation, the federal funding, or the advancement of the project, and then direct VDOT to report the results to you all for any further action. Thank you for consideration this time.
Thank you, Skip. The next speaker is Russell Ford, to be followed by Barbara Walsh. Welcome, Russell.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, ladies and gentlemen of the board. My name is Russell Ford, and I'm a member of the Board of Supervisors of Rockbridge County. I'm here to talk to you this morning about the truck climbing lane project on Interstate 81 between Timber Ridge and Fairfield in Rockbridge County, and the process of planning and building that project. In our county's business, we try to involve as many citizens as we can in every process of planning every action of our county board. We respectfully request that your board offers our citizens the same opportunity to participate fully in the planning and review of this project. In particular, I'm talking about a request to reinstate the Tier 2 economic and environmental study of this project before it goes forward. We have sent to your staff a resolution pretty much to that effect, and we welcome comments and questions from any and all members of the board. We've had an opportunity to talk to Dr. Davis about this morning, and we intend to come back to the Harrisonburg meeting in 2 weeks to bring up this and other matters. Thank you very much. I'd like to say that we enjoy working very much with our local and district VDOT staff. They're extremely professional, and we've had a good, productive relationship, even in these very challenging times, and we appreciate the work you do to do more with less. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Now, the next speaker is Barbara Walsh, to be followed by Patty Wood. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Secretary and members of the board. My name is Barbara Walsh, and I'm the Executive Director of the Rockbridge Area Conservation Council, which is a local citizens group that was formed 32 years ago to promote wise stewardship and sustainable use of natural and historic resources in the Rockbridge area. As you may know, over the past 5 years, RAC has been one of the many groups and individuals working diligently and in good faith with VDOT, VRPT, our elected officials, on issues related to improving the transportation system in the I-81 corridor. Rockbridge area residents have provided countless hours of volunteer time to help keep the public and localities informed, to publicize opportunities for citizen participation, and contribute the knowledge of local experts in science, engineering, land use planning, architecture, economics, and a host of other professions that we are extremely fortunate to have represented in our community and among our more than 500 members. Although many of the I-81 issues touch upon aspects of transportation planning that go far beyond the scope of the kinds of local issues that RAC typically focuses on, RAC realized early on that the decisions that were made for the corridor as a whole would eventually have very significant impacts directly on the residents, the economy, and the historical and natural resources of the Rockbridge area, and possibly even the very way of life and rural character that its citizens and visitors cherished so dearly. Now, however, we find that Rockbridge is in a completely different role as the location of the first of the targeted highway improvements on I-81 that will set a precedent for the standards and procedures of the projects that will follow throughout the rest of the corridor. This is a project to widen, as Rusty mentioned, 6.4 miles on the northbound side of the highway from Timber Ridge to just south of Raytheon. The planning process that has gotten us to this point has already achieved some notable outcomes that we think will serve other projects and communities well, such as the decision to move ahead with the targeted safety fix and to use competitive bidding procedures that will provide opportunities for local and regional firms to compete for these smaller scale projects. In addition to these accomplishments, the process has produced an, I think, absolutely unprecedented partnership involving private rail business, VDOT, VDRPT, and members of the General Assembly, Rail Advisory Board, and the CTB to initiate a multi-state highway speed intermodal rail feasibility plan for the I-81 corridor. We applaud the members of this board for their vision in recognizing the need to integrate the results of the rail plan into the ultimate design of an integrated transportation system for the corridor. It doesn't get much better than that. We truly thank the CTB for its role in guiding the process through the not always easy transitions from initial concepts through the ongoing stages of inquiry into the multi-pronged and still evolving design and implementation of solutions. Now for the challenges of the first project. RAC is here today to express its support for the resolution passed unanimously by the Rockbridge County Board of Supervisors and Lexington City Council to address the unresolved issues of local concern about the Rockbridge Truck Climbing Lane project, and to join with our local governments in asking the CTB to take whatever action is needed to help the affected locality secure a seat at the table to work collaboratively with VDOT and to resolve the issues about design and the NEPA categorical exclusion, as well as to ask for the CTB's support to allow enough time for successful resolution of these concerns before moving on to project phases that will make changes difficult or impossible. In addition to working sessions and adequate time for the localities to work together, We would also like to urge the CTB and VDOT to encourage the private sector to collaborate on seeking solutions to the design and impact concerns by specifically identifying those issues in the RFP and stating a preference for design-build proposals that are innovative, achieve green highway, context-sensitive, and low-impact design performance criteria, and use the FHWA ecosystems approach to design. A final task will then be to establish ranking criteria to select a proposal that best achieves these goals. Before concluding, I want to emphasize 2 points. First, I'd like to make it absolutely clear that RAC does not oppose a well-designed truck climbing lane, which we believe would consist of a single 12-foot lane design that accomplishes the job, namely to improve traffic flow and safety with minimal adverse impacts and without unnecessary expenditures for expanded full-depth shoulders. It simply doesn't make sense to us as taxpayers to spend lavishly on an oversized roadway in anticipation of a future widening project that has yet to be fully defined, and that the citizens of Rockbridge would then have to live with forever, regardless of any subsequent reductions in the ultimate highway section following the completion of the rail feasibility plan. And second, as the first of the targeted projects for I-81, the Rockbridge truck climbing lane should set the highest standard and serve as the model for innovation, context-sensitive design, and thorough NEPA study and mitigation, and the demonstrated responsiveness to the many citizen comments that were originally judged to be too specific to address at the Tier 1 EIS overview stage of NEPA study, as was promised to the board. Again, RAC fully supports and urges you to support the resolution passed by Rockbridge County Board of Supervisors and Lexington City Council. The resolution does not propose any specific design changes or studies, but identifies concerns arising from the information provided to date with the scale of the design, the categorical exclusion approach that has minimized the investigation and efforts to address both the economic and environmental impacts of the project on local residents and businesses and landowners. The resolution simply asks for a meaningful seat at the table for the affected localities and the time to work with VDOT to resolve the issues of significant local importance before the project proceeds further if it becomes too costly or difficult to make adjustments. Thank you again very much for the opportunity to address the board. I provided Carol Mathis with a copy of some additional specific technical comments and recommendations to distribute to any of the board members who would like to have more details about the particular issues. And I also have a few extra copies for anyone in the audience who might want to have them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara. The next speaker is Patty Wood, to be followed by Lee Merrill. Welcome, Patty.
Good morning. I would like to cede my time because I know that Barbara went over her time, and I would like to say that I echo her remarks and also support the resolution by the Board of Supervisors and City of Lexington. Thank you.
Thank you, Patty, and as we say often, brevity is rewarded. The next speaker is Lee Merrill, to be followed by Greg Amanetto.
Good morning to the members of the board, Mr. Secretary. I'm a resident of Rockbridge County. I'm an architect there, and I apologize for our slowness in our community to understand the full scale of what has been proposed. I think we were lulled to sleep to think that a truck climbing lane was an additional third lane, and while there was not necessarily uniform support for the need at this particular position on I-81 for this improvement, it caught a lot of us unaware, and I would like to make that apology for being slow, but we are amenable to a truck climbing lane, we are unconvinced of the requirement to build all future truck climbing lanes on the I-81 corridor to this section. And it concerns me tremendously that a precedent is being set here that's out of touch with the emerging global realities that we live in. And we're frustrated that this not a particularly unsafe stretch of the highway is targeted for nearly $100 million improvement, which many of us locally consider to be a considerable overbuilding and probably stalling other valuable and possibly more needed truck climbing lane situations in the Commonwealth and in the I-81 corridor. I want to encourage the members of this board to recognize a singular opportunity here today. and that is that VDOT's approach to the project is a flexible design build request for proposal process, and it could easily accommodate the kinds of changes or the kinds of modifications that might come out of a quick and timely review of some of the conclusions that have already been made about this project, so that it doesn't have to be unduly delayed to get a good truck climbing lane agreed to by all parties interested. I think this board has the responsibility of oversight to presume that we're doing the wisest and most cost-effective design, as this project will act as a model for truck climbing lanes and other assumptions about highway design on the I-81 corridor. There is an opportunity to benefit from best sustainable practices within the VDOT research groups that we've found out about, and in emerging ideas in the federal government about new ideas that are less demanding on our environment in terms of roadway design. So I'll finish with just asking that you grant our community this heartfelt request, we plead, to allow us to join with the excellent VDOT people we've been working with or starting to learn from in a meaningful collaboration to resolve these concerns and improve elegantly, perhaps, our Commonwealth transportation infrastructure. So thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Lee. The next speaker is Greg Amonetto. Amonetto, excuse me. And to be followed by David Foster. Welcome, Greg.
Good morning. I am Greg Amonetto. I'm a citizen of Rockbridge County, a former native of Lynchburg. Good to be back. Most of you are visitors. You probably don't remember Bedford County, which joined Lynchburg 50 years ago. I do. Rockbridge County is like Bedford County 50 years ago. It's a very, very special place. I'm a citizen, but I'm also a member of the board of the Rockbridge Area Conservation Council. And we, the council, our board of supervisors, the rest of the citizens of the county, work very, very hard to continue to make Rockbridge a very special place. As a result, we really have to be careful. The truck climbing lane is viewed against the economic realities of the county, the fact that it's based on tourism principally. We want to be careful about its historical values, cultural values, agricultural values, and do everything we can in studying this truck climbing lane to make sure that we have the best fit with all those important considerations. One thing I've heard here this morning that's come through loud and clear is that you have more work to do with fewer dollars. So clearly that would say that you have to give a lot of thought to this investment. And I would say that that includes the long-term consideration of the investment. And I would say that that includes considering rail alternatives to simply making highways bigger and bigger and having more impact on the areas that they travel through. So I echo what my colleagues and fellow citizens have said today. Please give us every opportunity to study this carefully before anything is concluded about this project in Rockbridge County. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg. The next speaker is David Foster, to be followed by Lisa Tracy. Welcome, David.
Good morning, gentlemen and ladies of the board. I have two brief comments this morning. And comment two, I want to allude to a handout. So I'm going to go ahead and give this to Ms. Matthews. Do comment number one in the interest of time. Comment number one is a rail-related comment. You won't find this surprising coming from the Executive Director of Rail Solution. This public hearing that we saw advertised here that was yesterday was to comment on the six-year plan. I don't know, maybe it's my own ineptitude, but I haven't found the six-year rail plan. So it seems to me that it's a little cart before the horse-ish situation here. I looked on the website. I didn't see in Chip Barger's presentation yesterday in his PowerPoint anything about the six-year rail plan. So I don't know how we can comment meaningfully on it. I think we need to have that before we comment. The DRPT is engaged right now in doing the statewide rail plan, which I think is supposed to be out in June. And I would urge that we have a practice and an atmosphere of transparency and public involvement in that. I think we need the public to be able to be involved in the creation of this plan and also to comment on the plan as we go along. My second comment relates to the email document that I have handed to you. And this just reinforces some of the comments that the people from Rockbridge County have already made, so I'll be brief. And in fact, you'll see that this, if you read like most emails, you should start on page 2 because the oldest email is at the bottom, and that's the one from Chris Collins, dated May 4th, 2007, where he comments more eloquently than I can about the problems with the design of the Rockbridge truck climbing lanes. And he's got a very handy 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 there for you. and I have highlighted the one that says almost any answer is okay except that we need it for a future improvement. In other words, he's trying to describe the independent utility concept that goes with a categorical exclusion, that anything related to the truck climbing lane must be necessary for the truck climbing lane. And he raises the question, could we do this without the extra width? And of course, I think the average person would think you could build a truck climbing lane without 5 or 6 lanes. And as you go through this rest of this email correspondence, you'll see that a meeting is held with the FHWA to discuss this. And then at the very top of the first page, poor Chris here is frustrated because he says the answer to item 1 is exactly what the regulations prohibit you from doing. And I think there's some of this going on out there. We have a categorical exclusion being used for these truck climbing lanes. And, of course, truck climbing lanes is a normal NEPA exclusion. But really what we have here is, in Rockbridge County, a typical road section of I-81 that'll have 5 12-foot lanes. And in the Montgomery County one, an ultimate profile I-81 over 8 miles that'll involve 6 12-foot lanes. And this goes well beyond a truck climbing lane, and it's really a 6.5 and 8 mile road widening project, respectively, that's kind of masquerading as a truck climbing lane, trying to get through with a categorical exclusion. So I just thought you ought to read that and understand that this is not something that is probably being handled the best way, not only in terms of saving taxpayer dollars, but also from an environmental standpoint as well. I really share the comments of this other speaker that went right before me, that in this time of fiscal crisis, that we should not be building gold-plated truck climbing lanes. We should be building typical truck climbing lanes where it gets the job done, and rather than trying to spend the whole $145 million federal earmark. Thank you.
Thank you, David. The next speaker is Lisa Tracy. Welcome, Lisa. And is there anybody else who wants to address the board after Ms. Tracy?
Good morning, Mr. Secretary and ladies and gentlemen of the board. I am Lisa Tracy, and I'm speaking as a resident of Lexington in Rockbridge County, and as a taxpayer concerned about how our national and Commonwealth dollars are going to be spent in a time of fiscal downturn. So it seems I'm echoing much of what you've heard, so I'm going to condense my remarks. Just to say that the future we were looking at in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, when the plan to widen I-81 in various ways throughout the corridor was first developed, is not the future we're looking at now, as we all know. In the past year or so, gas prices have climbed above $3 per gallon, and diesel fuel is now at as much as $4.50, with no sign that the hikes will stop anytime soon. And, of course, at the same time, rising fuel costs and an uncertain economy have added greatly to the costs of all sorts of endeavors, including construction, and the cost of transporting raw materials necessary for construction. earlier this week on radio station WMRA, Senator Cree Deeds and Mr. Homer spoke. Mr. Deeds mentioned that I believe some 40% of Virginia's bridges and tunnels are currently in substandard condition. And Mr. Homer confirmed, if I heard correctly, that the maintenance is increasingly challenging in an economy where Virginia is currently looking at, I believe, you said $450 million less than the transportation funds we've been counting on. This is not the future we were expecting even as recently as 4 years ago. It's time to reconsider and, of course, to be flexible enough to move with the times and to amend earlier plans in order to get the best use of our diminished state and federal transportation funds. In Rockbridge County, the stretch we've all been talking about this morning is not, unlike other stretches of 81, a stretch where there's particularly a significant safety hazard from congestion, merging lanes, or the uphill grade. A single lane in Rockbridge County would certainly be helpful, but there seems little evidence to support the addition of extensive additional grading that could eventually accommodate several extra lanes. The time for this thinking is past. We need the Commonwealth to spend our money where it will do the most good, and we believe that that is not by spending a very large proportion on additional widening that is much larger than what we think is eventually going to be needed. We very much appreciate the time, the thought, and the expertise that went into the original plans, but we believe that events have overtaken those plans in ways that none of us could have foreseen. It was very heartening to hear this morning an update on the needed state maintenance and on the development of VDOT's analytical database. We're asking you now, please, to bring this I-81 project in Rockbridge County down to a really reasonable size and thereby save needed funds to be spent for more urgently needed repairs and improvements. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anybody else wish to address the board? Okay, if not, we're going to go into our regular business session. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Action item 1A is the chief reference Christian in Fairfax County.
I move its adoption, Mr.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 1B is the chief reference Christian in the town of Berryville.
Move approval, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The local assistance division. Mr. Estes is here to answer any questions. Action item 2A is a Virginia byway designation in Page County.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 3 is economic development assets in Lunenburg County.
Move approval. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 4 is revenue sharing program policy. We had a presentation and discussion on this at the last work session.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Comment, Secretary. There's no provision here for this to come back to the board for approval after the commissioner develops the policy. Should that not come back to this board?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bowie, this would be similar to other guides that we have where this is before we had taken brought the full guide to the board. What we've done is create a policy to represent the high level and the represent the details that were laid out in the new code change, and then we were going to do a guide like we do our other policies. So this is a new policy that we haven't had before. So the plan was not to bring the full guide with the details of the program implementation, but we by all means can share that with the board or however you guys would see best see fit.
Well, I understand the need for it to be developed by the commissioner. My question is, should that not come back to this board for final approval after it has been developed?
What I might suggest, we don't want to get too much in the weeds here as a policy board. I do think that the staff could bring that back as a presentation if we have questions that way. The guidance documents, by their definition, there's always an exception to the rule, and that's part of the process of having that, is to build in some administrative flexibility. But those will be brought back to the board as they develop.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of clarification on the requirements for this. Do the projects in which these go to, they must be in the six-year or the secondary six-year plan, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Sterling, those projects would have to either be in one of our programs Or they could be in a local capital improvement program.
Not necessarily the secondary six-year program.
Not necessarily the secondary six-year program.
There's a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 5A is location approval in the city of Newport News. My recollection is that this dates back to the 1940s or 50s.
Well, probably not that far, but it's
I remember
old.
As well.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 5B is location approval in Smith County. It's an interchange in 81 and exit 47.
Move the approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Right-of-way and Utilities Division, Coburn is here to answer any questions. Action item 6A is Route 11 and Old Route 11 Valley Turnpike. Are there any questions for Mr. Coburn?
Move approval, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Route 1110 in Halifax County. Are there any questions for Mr. Coburn?
Move approval, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 6C, which is Route 604 in Charlotte County. Are there any questions, Mr. Coburn?
I move approval, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 6B is Route 780 in Gloucester County.
I move approval, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 7 is a request for approval to issue Commonwealth of Transportation Capital Revenue Bonds. Ms. Butcher is here to answer any questions along with Mr. Anderson. And just by way of historical note, not all of House Bill 3202 was eliminated by the Supreme Court decision. One was a $3 billion bond authorization spread out over 10 years, about $300 million a year on average. And the first draw on this is to match our federal dollars. Very important is that maintenance growth consumes state dollars. We have less and less ability to match federal dollars. These bonds, if we took these bonds away from our program today, we would have a very challenging situation.
Mr. Chairman,
this is a thin line of defense, I would say. Before we go to questions, Ms. Butcher, did you have any introductory comments you wanted to make?
Certainly. As the Secretary indicated, staff is developing for sale, potentially in June, the first series of the Commonwealth of Virginia Transportation Capital Project Revenue Bonds, as authorized by Chapter 896 of the Acts of the General Assembly. The Act authorizes the CTB to issue from time to time revenue obligations of the Commonwealth to be designated Commonwealth of Virginia Transportation Capital Project Revenue Bonds at one or more times in an aggregate principal amount not to exceed $3 billion, provided that the aggregate principal amount issued in any one fiscal year does not exceed $300 million, excluding any refunding bonds. These bonds would be issued over or be outstanding for a period of 25 years. And we would be looking to sell these bonds in a competitive sale. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman, is it accurate to say that if we don't approve this, this book's much thinner? That's what I thought. In that case, I move.
So,
I just had a quick question. What is the expected response from the capital markets, if there's any thought on that, with the credit crunch that's out there?
Actually, I believe the response would be a positive one, given Virginia's bond rating and the fact that this has been developed within the capacity of the Commonwealth to issue debt.
And now, Ms. Butcher, this after this approval has to go to the Treasury Board as well. Correct?
Yes, we're on their agenda for next month. So then we would look. The earliest we could sell would be June.
And that's important to understand about these bonds. A FRAN, which is a CTV note, really there's not a lot of involvement of the Treasury Board in oversight because that's purely within transportation revenues. This is the dedication of the insurance premium taxes that's what's supporting this, and it is debt of the Commonwealth. friends don't count against our debt limit. That's a statewide debt limit. This is a new and different and very significant animal. And the first authorization, the first sale, sets the precedent for future sales. So it's very, very important that we do this right and put our best foot forward in the capital market.
Mr. Chairman, would it be safe to frame it as borrowing money and paying interest on that to be able to utilize some federal funds that otherwise would be available to us if we had proper financing?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, a question. Given the status and the impact that the borrowing has on our long-term debt and on our future budget payments, and the situation we're presently in with the pending special session, is there any benefit to delaying action while the discussion is pending? It would appear that at least at this juncture, there might be some benefit in the legislative process to re-examine the significant exposure to debt that the legislature has elected to impose. And taking this action, it seems to me, says we are concurring with the legislature. I understand the need for the money and to keep things on track. I just wonder if it isn't better to perhaps pause and let the special session consider the impact of the debt load that they're imposing on the Commonwealth and the future budgets that we're going to have to deal with.
Excellent question. What this resolution does is allow the business of VDOT and the Treasury staff to establish a credit relationship with the market. The ultimate decision to go ahead with the sale is exclusively the government. And so I think we can accommodate both interests. That's an excellent suggestion, though. And, you know, it might not be a bad idea, Ms. Buescher, to just develop what things might look like in the absence of this.
Certainly.
I think it's fair to say that our program is extremely, perhaps critically, reliant on this debt program.
Excuse me. Sorry. To follow up on what Mr. Davies said in your earlier comment, I think there's a misconception among a number of people that 3202 generated a lot of new sustainable revenue for a statewide basis. To me, this is debt and is certainly not sustainable revenue. Would it be to our advantage to prepare some type of paper, and maybe you've already done that, some type of white paper that really illustrates that what 3202 didn't do was provide new sustainable statewide revenue, if I understand correctly.
Well, and I'll ask Ms. Buescher or the Commissioner, Ms. Tucker, if they want to chime in as well, but the repayment source for these bonds are the insurance premium taxes, which have been promised since the year 2000 to transportation and never dedicated. The way that legislation was written, it was written in such a way to have the left hand and the right hand have the cake and to eat it too. And the one thing that did happen was it was made very clear that those insurance premium taxes are now transportation revenue. So there is a dedicated revenue source for these bonds, which is a plus for transportation, but that comes at the expense of the general fund. Those had previously been general fund revenues. And so, for example, we have the $505 million of one-time general fund revenues at the end of last year's budget that we put towards a variety of projects. The general fund revenue projections went down. We've taken $180 million out of that. So we are absolutely moving back and forth between the left hand and the right hand, between transportation funding and general funds. And I think the larger issue is one that's going to get taken up and when this goes to the Treasury Board, it'll be interesting to see, because there has to be a fairly substantial amount of debt for the college building program and some of the other things, but it's just apparently they've reached an accommodation on that. And at the end of the day, what we need in our world of capital planning is stable, reliable, predictable, whether or not we choose to pledge some portion of that to debt. And right now we're moving back and forth between general funds and transportation funds. So I think you've hit a very important issue. And Butch has obviously mentioned something there. And we'll go back, I think, and think about that. Maybe a simple way to do it would be to ask the question, what would it be like without the debt, but with this, say, as a pay-as-you-go option? Because one of the things, and in our last six-year program, when we leave here, or when I leave here, that last six-year program will extend to 2016. By our estimate, we will be, in that year 2016, unable to fully match federal dollars. This board will see that six-year program. And there are two major factors that lead to that situation. The first is the growing maintenance cost we talked a lot about this morning. The second is you get 10 years of bonds and then nothing. And so that ability to match federal dollars, remember we talked about canary in the coal mine, that rising percentage of federal expenditures, we're rapidly approaching that point. And a lot of people think 10 years is a long ways away, but this board will start to see that in its, 2010 six-year program.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Boucher, how much of the debt service that we talked about yesterday in the six-year plan is represented by this? In other words, how much would you free up if we didn't have increasing debt load as a way of financing, an unsustainable way of financing our program?
I'm sorry, I don't have that number on the top of my head.
Can you give me a round guess? I won't hold you to the exact number. Well, maybe you ought to do this. Maybe you ought to have that number available as well, as long as you're going to look at what's the program look like without $300 million of debt. What would it look like without the debt in the first place that we'd be able to apply to our programs and get sustainable revenue from the gas tax or the sales tax or someplace else that goes into the trust fund rather than paying off new debt by, in effect, using general fund dollars, which are not supposed to be used for transportation?
Well, it's important to understand, though, the dedication of the insurance premium tax, that is now a transportation revenue. That's done. That's a good thing from the maintenance of our program, I think. The question is, would we be better served taking that what's now $140, $150 million a year with very significant growth potential and using that on a pay-as-you-go basis,
right,
or using it as part of the debt program? And that's a fair question. I think it would be helpful, to ask that question. We'd free up a little bit of resources. I know Ms. Bush's staff is pretty challenged right now with the six-year program.
Well, that's essentially what you put it perhaps more directly, but if you use that money directly to fund projects instead of to finance debt, what would we be able to do?
If you're selling about $100 million of bonds, you'd be looking at interest or debt service of about $10 million or a little less a year.
Plus the repayment of the debt.
But we would try to level our payments out. We'd be looking at about $10 million on $100
Is that dedicated revenue available for construction and operations, or is it limited to debt service?
No, it's actually a blend. So let's just say, for sake of argument, there's $140 million worth of insurance premium revenues, and we sell, say, $300 million worth of bonds, which is $25 million of debt service. The remainder falls into the program and goes towards other priority projects. It's actually discretionary money, but the first draw on all of that is going to be to match federal dollars. And the reason for that is the federal dollars, the match now comes off the top of the individual district. So if you are lucky enough to get an interstate project in your district, like widening of 64, it's going to take up a lot of your primary and other allocations that's matching.
requirements. And so it's important to provide that insulation between the state allocations and the need to match those with the federal dollars. That didn't used to be a problem when we had a very healthy, better balance of state and federal revenues, but we don't have a healthy balance today.
And just a clarification, these are called revenue bonds, but there's no real then connection to revenue.
We'll strike that question from the record.
It's just a bean counter asking that question.
The revenue comes, Mr. Chairman, the revenue comes from the fact that the General Assembly appropriates the money into a special fund and that's the source of the revenue that will be used. So in the capital markets.
Something like full faith and credit general obligation bonds.
Right. It's to make that
It's a 90 bond like the Route 58 program or the Northern Virginia District Bond program or the set-aside fund. Okay, any other?
One final question for me. Mr. Chairman, if we are going to be called upon to consider this type of bond issue on an annual basis, that's the way the program at least has been designed, are there criteria, and I pose this as a question without an answer, are there criteria we should develop on how to actually judge the wisdom of that approval from year to year? I mean, it's sort of easy to do because we can do it, but I think you've heard here there's some criteria that at least some people have in mind about the wisdom of selling these types of bonds given certain political circumstances, economic circumstances, other investment type decisions we make. I understand the ultimate call will be the governor's, and probably maybe I'm answering my own question as I talk, that if he has the freedom, he or she has the freedom to make the final decision, I suppose all those factors will come into play at that point. Maybe I'll just ask it this way. Would you expect that we would, as a matter of course, authorize the selling of these bonds each year for the next 10 years?
We would have to. This authorization is not a 10-year blanket authorization, is it?
That's not what you're doing today.
That's minimum. I think it's a fair question to look at some alternatives. We've got to go through, and there's a presumption built into our program and the legislation. I think we're going to deviate from that course. We want to do some analysis and have a conversation and ask some hard questions here and provide that commentary back ultimately to the governor. We might have a conversation with Secretary of Finance, but I think it's a fair and important set of questions. And it comes down to, can you now or can you later?
So this resolution authorizes the sale and then grants you and the governor the decision to make the sale, two separate items.
Yes, sir. And it also, there's a comparable exercise that will be undertaken at the Treasury Board. And they're going to view this, they may take a little bit of time, they may want to look at the details of the college building bond bill that will be discussed during a special session next week. Because these bonds affect the state debt limitations, they need to balance on a year-to-year basis to make sure this all fits together. And as a AAA state, Virginia will do absolutely nothing that jeopardizes our creditworthiness or our bond rating.
Mr. Chairman, I move the resolution.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
I have one other comment. You will know that.
Mr. Harris, could you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. My name is Arthur Anderson. I'm with McGuire Woods in Richmond, and we are bond counsel of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I did want to point out that in the resolution, there is an acknowledgement that the issuance of these bonds has been challenged in a case that was filed in Richmond Circuit Court, Joseph B. Commonwealth. The Office of the Attorney General is handling that litigation. I want to mention that because the Treasury Board may wish to see some progress in that case before they will give their approval, even though we are scheduled in May. And, of course, the governor may want also to see that that litigation has been dealt with before he would give approval. And that, in that way, we would enhance the marketability of the bonds and make sure we get the proper rating from the rating agencies and that sort of thing.
Mr. Chairman, is it unfair to ask just maybe a one-minute explanation for what the challenge to it is?
Yes. There are two grounds. One is the what we call the single object rule in the Virginia Constitution, that House Bill 3202 just threw in everything with the kitchen sink, or included everything with the kitchen sink. That particular challenge was dealt with in the NVTA validation case. The Supreme Court held that HB 3202 doesn't violate the single object rule. The other ground is a based on section or Article 10, Section 9 of the Constitution, which is the debt, the state debt provisions. And the challenge there is that this is that these are bonds backed by tax revenues of the Commonwealth of Virginia, which they have a bootstrapping analysis. It's very complicated. I don't think there's a need to go into that. But basically, they're saying that the General Assembly didn't provide to take these bonds to referendum, and they're full faith and credit. Now, in our view, on Council's view, the success of that challenge would depend on the Supreme Court overturning a whole line of special fund doctrine cases. Because, again,
thank you.
Full faith is not closed.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Fisher or Mr. Sims? Thank you very much. That motion passes. We come to our favorite part of the session. Welcome, Mr. Coburn. Is this a good month or a bad month?
Pretty good month, sir.
You said that with a smile.
This is
for that business report on NPR every day. I was watching Myron's Body English. That's the upscale music there. We have a series of replacement pages as well, correct?
Yes, sir. What I'm here to present to you this morning are bids we received on March 26th, TAMS contract in October of last year. Those are the white sheets. The pink sheets are additional bids which we received on the 1st of April and a project by the City of Salem received on the 3rd of April. Those came in too late to get in your package in normal course of business.
Okay, let's start right at page one.
Yes, sir. Beginning with page one, this is one of our federal plant mix contracts for Stafford County. We received two bids on these, and this does represent a good bid. Since last month, we've seen, just as you have personally seen, increases in fuels, increases in asphalt prices from the bulk, and increases in those commodities that are petroleum-based. Just as a general rule, even in the last 2 weeks, we've seen an increase in reinforcing steel from about $2.40 a pound to $2.70 a pound, with a shortened quote period. Quotes right now are being honored for 14 days. So the market is tightening, and we're looking at all those things as we go. I say that so that to give you some sense of the analysis we go through when I'm telling you from staff analysis that we believe these are good bids and recommend its approval.
Mr. Chairman. Quick question. We heard earlier that asphalt's going up. You touched about it, but when I look at the bid amount in comparison to what we had estimated it cost, and I see this in other places with asphalt involved, it's substantially lower.
What's the result of the bids coming in so much lower if the asphalt's up?
The asphalt item itself, from what was predicted, is not necessarily lower. There are other items in this bid. The milling, the other safety appliances, and those types of things. So in total, that estimate represents a good value.
Those other elements, that large of a component of this overall project, that the price down on them would, I mean, that's almost $1 million less.
In this project,
20% less.
Without getting into the details, I believe those other items represent about 28% to 30% of this total contract.
But the bid itself is about 20% less than what we estimated the cost to be.
The item that was set in the six-year plan for construction, I believe, was overly optimistic.
Or pessimistic.
Overly pessimistic when it was established.
Okay.
Previously.
Well, I think it raises a good general question, too, in contrast to what Connie Sorrell presented this morning about a 50% increase in highway maintenance. I think that's right. Costs. How much? Largely due, I think you said, to the price of asphalt. I mean, in fact, I'm getting a sense that maybe that isn't the determining factor. And is there a disconnect between what we're actually seeing in bids today and what we're planning for, I guess is my question. Because it looks like we should be seeing increased costs on these bids, and instead, for the last 6 months in a row, they've been going straight down to our advantage.
You need to look at the next couple, I think.
and I guess I would say the commodity, obviously, is a big part of this, but labor, equipment rentals, there are very big machines that apply to the rental rate. And so, yes, you're seeing escalation on the commodity rate, in a more competitive market for labor, for some of the equipment that otherwise would be idle, as well as some of the assets and the resurfacing and drainage work and restriping and things like that. Is there a motion?
I'll move.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, page two.
Page two, the first item, A44. Our White County. This is a bridge replacement of the Blackwater River. You'll notice this is typical of some of our roadway and bridge replacement projects. We got a lot of bids on this. This does represent a very good value, and we recommend its award.
And is this where there was a very serious flooding about 3 years ago?
I'm not familiar with that one.
But I'm not sure this bridge is it. I don't know.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Out of what? And second.
The next project, K-47, again, is a federal plant mix project containing other items as well as plant mix. Only one bidder. We do not believe we'll get a better price on this, and we recommend its approval.
Is there a motion?
Motion.
Okay. Second?
Second.
All in favor? Steve, I'm sorry.
Byron, this is, I guess it's my standard question. It always concerns me when I see one bidder and the price is higher than what we had in the six-year plan. And I assume, based on what you said, that the bid is within the engineer's estimate.
It's very close to the engineer's estimate.
It's above the engineer's estimate.
It's very close to the engineer's estimate. Yeah.
Close to nice try.
Yeah, but he's faster than I am. I can't do it. Well, given your comments a moment ago about the price of steel, the bids are only good for 14 days. Without describing the complete process and giving away anything in confidence, what can you tell us that gives us more comfort on how accurate the engineer's estimate is these days when you're evaluating a project where there's only one bidder?
We spend a significant amount of time researching the market, and one of the groups in our section that's an internal group is calling suppliers, developing quotes, just as they were a contractor. And we are We are looking at those commitment dates. We're looking very aggressively at what an aggressive schedule for building that project would give us. We also write our specifications as a shared risk type of contract, where certain items, there are escalation clauses. Asphalt items are one of those, and there are fuel adjustment items in certain commodities within a contract that the contractor can either opt in and receive a degree of protection for future inflation, or opt out based on his particular bidding strategy. So we have looked internally and developed various techniques that we can contractually share that risk and recognize an individual business owner's strategy to bid against us, essentially.
One other brief question, Mr. Chairman. The a few years ago, when we were discussing the problem with one bidder project, part of the explanation was that the contractors out there, because of the low volume of highway work, they were doing shopping centers and things like that, because the economy was down, they could make more money on those projects. Now that the economy is turned down, this project has one bidder and the next one has one bidder as well. Is there any change of thinking now in terms of why we're only getting one bid on these projects, or do you see light at the end of the tunnel?
A lot of the asphalt type of work is based on the number of firms that are in that business. In this area of the state, there are very few producers in the Hampton Roads area, as example. Most of the aggregate is trucked in or barged in. So when you look at all the ingredients that make up asphalt, the sand, the aggregates, the asphalt binder, there's a lot of freight cost that's builds into those things coming in. There's a limited market of the number of players that are selling that product to us. On the other hand, we pay well, and we pay on time. And so that protection is one of the things that the industry, the asphalt industry, and all of our contractors recognize that we do honor our commitments and we do pay, and they recognize that. Probably if we could look in to a firm's bid records, we would see a tighter margin on work that they do for us because of that reliability and consistency than some of that that's in the private market.
I think Mr. Colburn sort of answered my question, because I was going to suggest that maybe Branscom has incredible market share in asphalt plants in this particular region, and there aren't many other equal-sized competitors out there producing asphalt.
That's correct.
I need to abstain. I can't hear you.
Branscom is on my board.
Could I make one quick comment, since we were talking about engineers' estimates? In a conversation earlier this week with a gentleman from a major construction company who's very active in Virginia and most other states as well as overseas, there was a casual reference to Florida beginning in certain circumstances to actually release their engineers' estimate with the bid documents. In other words, to share its own information and to prompt discussions earlier in the process if they were offline or so forth. So I don't know what to do with that. I don't know what the circumstances there are, but I would be very interested in learning, one, if that were true, and two, the circumstances under which that occurs, because we're in an information age here, and it's this is the way we've always done things, but sharing of information is the new norm in business, not hiding information. And collaboration is the new norm of business, not sort of the false advocacy relationship where somebody wins, somebody loses if money is this or money is that. So I would like to see if someone could maybe look into that and, you know, maybe brief us on those circumstances at some point, that there's some alternative ways of doing this.
We'll certainly look at that. All right, there's a motion and second on the floor. Any other questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Page 3, Salem District.
This is a normal route, excuse me, order number 213 is a normal district-wide plant mix schedule. Again, you, as you mentioned, there's only one bidder on this project. We do believe this is a good bid and recommend its approval.
I move approval.
Second.
This project is one of the TAMS contracts. This one is Stanton North. We did receive three bids on this project back in October. There was a significant negotiation that occurred through this, which I believe resulted in basically around a $7 million savings. The staff has looked at it, and over the length of the contract, we recommend its approval.
Move approval, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
Any questions? Big contract. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? We're turning to page 5.
In Rockland County, this is a concrete pavement repair, edge drains, etc. Had two bidders interested in this project. We believe this is a very good bid and recommend its approval.
Move approval. Second.
In favor?
Aye.
This is another type of pavement reclamation and asphalt overlay project, a little different from the previous. Again, we had two bidders on this project. We believe it's a good bid and recommend its approval.
I would move approval.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
You'll note my abstention, Blakemore Construction is a client of my firm.
The last project is a City of Salem project. Bids were received on April the 3rd. This is a replacement of Colorado Street Bridge over the Roanoke River. This project contains a 10-foot greenway for pedestrians and cyclists as part of this. Again, you'll see we had five bidders on this project. Good interest, and we recommend this award.
I'll certainly move approval.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Are there anybody who wants to bring any items up under new business? Mark.
While you're being passed up, given a handout, I'll talk. One of the things that I came across in my business life and came to adopt as a guiding principle is that the one doing the job best knows how that job should be done. And earlier today, Mr. Russell talked about Henry County Board of Supervisors. Henry County Board of Supervisors passed a resolution asking us to consider the possibility of what indeed in the scope of things would be minor changes to the I-73 routing. However, it would be quite major to them. And considering that the Board of Supervisors, the citizens, numerous business and private interests have asked us to consider that, I did look into it, and simplifying it, what we are being asked to consider is using more of existing interstate standard road in the Martinsville area, and that's essentially what it comes down to. All the rest of those things are ancillary, and many of them probably would come out to be as projected, but you know, some might not be as good as we would think. Overall, though, it came out to be a logical thing to support. The resolution that you see in front of you, I have had vetted by people who are far more intelligent, or at least far, far better paid than I. to the purpose of avoiding aggravating existing obstacles to the project or creating new obstacles to the project. While personally I endorse this resolution, the only reason I'm not asking us to vote right now is I am deferring to some wisdom from my colleague Jim Boyd that we be sure to honor both the spirit and the letter of transparency, and to say that we would take time and look at actually voting next month, now that I publicly offer this resolution.
So this is really an informational item, and we'll schedule this as an action item as appropriate. I think there are this goes as an issue about transparency. Obviously important. We would never undertake a resolution like this without some advance notice to the affected communities, and also without consultation with Federal Highway Administration, and they're the ultimate arbiter on the issues of their litigation, and we need to understand that they're a potential committee as well. But thank you for putting this together. We've heard this repeatedly now at several of the public hearings, and it's our responsibility as the board ultimately to address the situation at the appropriate time. Any other items under new business?
Mr. Chairman, I do have a brief informational item. I'm providing to the members of the board a summary sheet, which beginning May 1st, we will routinely provide to members of the board. And it's a piece of information that we track in the department, have for many years. And I'm we'll go into a much more in-depth explanation of what's in here, but in concept, what this shows you is at the end of the day, the decisions you make, as you just did, turns into work on the road. And so what this gives you in a very quick summary, I think, is a pretty powerful piece of information in terms of the construction and maintenance contracts that we have underway. And so if you look at this status as of April 1st, you will note that we have about 108 construction contracts currently underway that this board or I have approved under the processes that we use, and about 231 maintenance contracts. It shows you their contract value total and the amount that is left to be paid, or the incomplete balance based on progress that is going on. Like engineers' estimates and everything else, there's nuance and subtlety within this data. But as I've reviewed it, I've found it to be one of those guideposts that kind of ties things together for me at the beginning of every month. What actions have we taken? What has it turned into? And where is it? So we'll bring this back on a routine basis, probably on a monthly basis, as we make awards. And I have no doubt that this will start to raise some additional questions from the board in explanation as we move forward. But I thought this was much more interesting than looking at banking information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Pleasure,
thank you. There's a subtlety to that, and I know there'll be some conversation after.
Thank you for this. I think it's good to remember that this body sees contracts over $2 million, I think, is the threshold. The majority of the contracts, highway construction contracts, are less than $2 million. The mere number of contracts not necessarily total. Okay, if there's nothing else, the meeting is adjourned.